good afternoon. My name is Maria Mejia.
And I'm Ali Schultes.
And if you could just introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
If you could just say your name and class year really quickly.
Yeah, hi. I'm Russell Frisbee. I was sophomore class of 72. I got my degree in political science, international relations with a concentration in black studies.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. So to start off, we want to ask an introductory question. If you could please just briefly share your memories of your time at Swarthmore. What was it like to be a black student at Swarthmore at that time?
It was an interesting time. It was in the late 60s, early 70s. I came to Swarthmore in September 68. If you know anything about 1968, it was a very tumultuous time throughout the country with Vietnam War, civil rights, etc. And to some extent, Swarthmore became the focal point of a lot of those activities, that discussion in the Philadelphia area. So it was an interesting time to be at Swarthmore. A lot of good people, a lot of challenging situations.
Mm. We were wondering how black students in general, if you would want to speak to your experience, maybe in SAS or just as a student, how black students in general kind of coped with the atmosphere particular to Swarthmore during this time.
Okay, it was. I was there during a time of transition. I was there when I first came to Swarthmore. In my class, there were 8 black students because the dean of admissions didn't think that you should have too many more black women than black men, because otherwise black women wouldn't have anybody to date. While I was there, by the time my second year, you started having a growth in numbers. So the interaction among the black students changed. I think during my time, at least the last 3 years, I think the black students, really SAS grew. There was more, I think black students call less around SAS than they had in the past. I think prior to that time period, there was SAS, and there were a lot of other black students, but who didn't necessarily associate with SAS. Then SAS grew, the black students coalesced around SAS. Then toward the end of my time, I think there were a number of black students who probably were uncomfortable with some of the politics of SAS, and they formed the gospel choir almost as a counter-SAS.
Mm. Thank you. We noticed that you were the Minister of Information for SAS, and we were wondering what that entailed.
It was more of a title. I did not want to be, whatever, with school and everything, I did not want to be the chairman of SAS, so I just picked the title, and basically there was a group effort in the steering committee, and I was very much involved, probably as number 2 person. A lot of times that meant that I became the spokesperson for SAS.
Okay. So you mentioned that some students were uncomfortable with the politics of SAS. Can you talk more about that, or about, in general, the culture and social dynamic within the group?
Well, at one point toward the end, I was called a communist, but aside from that, I think this was the era, the height of the Black Power era, and there were some students, black students, who were uncomfortable with that notion, and that did create some friction. It wasn't a tense situation, but there was some tension. But I think particularly in, say, 69, 70, there was more of a unity, because we'd gone through the 2 takeovers, the first of the admissions office and the president's office, and then we were getting the Black Studies program off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. We were wondering if you through your participation in SAS and the takeover, if you ever met Sam Shepard or got to know Sam Shepard, because we were not able to interview him and we wanted to kind of...
Yeah, I knew Sam. I knew Sam. We weren't particularly close friends.
Okay.
But I knew Sam.
Okay. What was your understanding of his role on campus during the takeover of the admissions office?
I didn't think he had a particularly big role.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And we also, Clinton Etheridge was on campus for the past, I think, 2 weeks, and he talked a lot about, or he mentioned your relationship and being close with you, and we were just wondering if you could maybe speak to that relationship, and also to how Mr. Etheridge kind of handled Swarthmore after the takeover, like in the semester afterwards.
Clint was sort of a father figure. I was a freshman. I came to Swarthmore at the ripe old age of 17.
Mm.
And, you know, Clint was really the elder of the group, and, you know, we were close. He became a father figure and a leader and sort of the cooler head to sort of think through everything. But also because of the fact that I was a freshman, he was a senior, that I guess his last semester was so tumultuous. It was tumultuous for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know, we didn't really have a lot of talks about what Clint was going through, how he was feeling. I mean, by that point, I was probably closer to people my age, such as Don Mizell. So I didn't have as much contact with Clint. I remember reading his article later, and I didn't realize as much was going on in his life, or Clint had become even the target or that he may have become, which is kind of funny, because it was more, even then, it was more of a group process than I think outsiders really understood.
So, reflecting on SAS and the 1969 sit-in, can you tell us how SAS came to the decision to employ direct action and to take over the admissions office?
Well, I think you need to talk to Clint and folks like Marilyn Hollifield, because, quite frankly, my sense of looking back on it is, by the time I got there in September, that decision was kind of already made,
mm-hmm.
and it was moving to that. I know by December it was under, you know, it was really under active discussion, and sort of it just perked forth in January, and sort of so I was involved at the end in terms of the final meetings. We were going to do this. We didn't have any other options because we weren't getting anywhere with the administration. But I really can't say that I was sort of involved in the path to that. I can talk about the 70 takeover, the following takeover, but I really how we got there, but not about the 69.
Okay, thank you. Would you say, it seems like from what you've said then, that maybe some of the older students really mobilized this first takeover, but then afterwards pretty quickly, like a younger group within SAS took over? Would you say that's an accurate statement? Or?
That's very accurate.
Okay.
That's very accurate. I think it was mainly the seniors who organized that takeover, and then by the next year it would have been the juniors and the sophomores. The folks in the class of 71 and 72 at that point took over.
Okay, thank you. We just wanted to ask you about the atmosphere in Parrish during that time, and then we were going to move to ask you some questions about the 1970 takeover.
Okay. Well, it was tense. I mean, it was a tense situation. Obviously, it's tense. You're in there. You have, all of a sudden you see yourself on CBS News, people being pulled through the admissions office window. It became a national issue. It got very tense, and then unfortunately Courtney Smith died, which nobody expected. So then we left in honor of that. So it was inside. We felt It was something we had to do, but it was a very tense situation because who knew what was going to happen? Who knew what that was going to mean for our futures? I think most of our parents had decided that we had just thrown away our college careers and our future careers or whatever. That didn't happen, but you just never knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so our questions about the 1970 sitting are specifically, why do you think it was important for Swarthmore students to have their own space? Because the 1970 sitting was tied to the creation of the Black Cultural Center.
It was tied to the creation of the Black Cultural Center and the Black Studies program. We thought that particularly the Black Studies program was important. It was necessary to bring the focus of Black Studies to Swarthmore in the various departments, obviously particularly history and political science. And also really the Black Cultural Center was related there too as a way, really a place for the Black, a home for the Black students and for the Black Studies program. But again, it was as much a Black Studies program as a cultural center.
Okay. Could you talk about kind of the decision leading to 1970, the discussions around planning that direct action? It sounds like you were more involved with that decision.
Yes, there was. Again, there was a sense that we really weren't getting anywhere. Now, to some extent, looking back, it was probably also, that's what everybody was doing back then. I mean, you had, you had Swarthmore, you had Columbia, you had Cornell. I mean, there were a lot of takeovers, and that between the civil rights and Vietnam takeovers were de rigueur, shall we say. But we thought we'd reach an impasse, and that we had to do something dramatic, and taking over the president's office was dramatic. I know we'd had a torchlight parade to the president's house that sort of shocked a lot of folks, but we felt in order to achieve our goal, we had to do something dramatic, and that dramatic was the takeover of the president's office.
So once you had decided that you were going to take this direct action, what was it like being in the president's office? I think some of the other people we're interviewing have talked about it, but just if you could talk more about what it was like sitting in at the president's office.
Well, by that point, I was an old-handed sitting in, so from my point of view, it was a lot less tense than the year before. Not only was it less tense, but there was more of an air. I'm not sure we took it as seriously as we should have, because to some extent, for some folks, it was, a lot of us are serious, but for some folks, it was a lark. It was the thing to do. As I recall, it ended pretty quickly with, I think it was Dave Cawson. It was involved. We were able to negotiate something with the administration, and it ended pretty quickly. But I remember the funniest thing is having Domino's pizza delivered to the president's office, which is absurd, but that's one of the things you remember.
No, absolutely. No, thank you. I think you wanted to ask. We were wondering within this discussion of the Black Cultural Center, what role you think questions about the legality of space and like the inclusiveness of space actually played in the administration's maybe hesitancy to move as quickly as you would have liked.
I don't know. I mean, perhaps. But I don't recall a lot of discussion about that. I think it was more that, or at least that much of that was the reason they were given. It was just that, no, they didn't want to do it, and it just a lot of opposition. But we didn't hear from them a lot of arguments with regard to legality or inclusiveness.
Okay.
That was not something that was raised.
Okay.
Or, I think raised in a serious fashion, let's put it that way.
So you mentioned that the 1970s sit-in was not just about the Black Cultural Center, but also about Black studies, and we were hoping you could talk more about how Black studies looked in the beginning, like the Black philosophies of Liberation course that took place during the 1969 semester was like a student-run course, and that's one example of what Black studies looked like at the beginning. So if you could just talk more about that, that would be
great. I'm not sure I took that course, but it was later on, obviously, Catherine Morgan. She was the person who really got the Black Studies program off the ground. We had other people involved before then, but it was really Catherine Morgan who got the program off the ground, who gave it integrity. Recognized at that time, there was a tremendous debate between the, shall we say, the cultural nationalists or the Black nationalists and the revolutionary nationalists who were, I think maybe the Panthers would fall on the revolutionary nationalist side, along with SDS and groups like that. So a lot of the political discussion was geared around the whole question of cultural nationalism, which meant that the problem was a problem of race versus revolutionary nationalism, which meant that the problem was a problem of caste. So to some extent, I think a lot of the discussion, both in the classes and in the dorms, et cetera, revolved around how to deal with those issues. And then clearly, there was a split in the community along those lines. For instance, I think you've heard of the Seven Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
They would probably be cultural nationalists, and their focus was on race. Other folks were, particularly those of us who got more involved in the anti-Vietnam protests, began to focus more on revolutionary nationalism and focusing on some of the economic/war issues, as opposed to simply focusing on the racial issues. So again, though, you saw those tensions throughout, and also that also led to the tension of, well, how closely do I identify with SAS, the group?
Mm-hmm.
So you had all of those multitude of discussions going on all the time.
Between the cultural nationalists and the revolutionary nationalists, which way do you think SAS ended up being steered near the end, or what direction were the leadership?
I would say more toward revolutionary nationalism, because again, you had the Vietnam War going on, so there were a lot of what we did merge into some of the anti-Vietnam War, but it was really down the middle, because at the same point, obviously, we're pushing strongly for the Black Studies program, trying to get that off the ground. By that point, Catherine Morgan had her classes going on. She did a great job in terms of the history and the cultural history. So we were all over the line.
Okay, thank you.
Just as another follow-up to that, do you think any of these divisions were along gender lines, or were there other disagreements that you think emerged in SAS along gender?
Well, it's interesting, because that was probably a generational divide, in that the older students, quite frankly, I think the seniors were much more divided along gender lines than the younger students.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I do believe that a lot of the Seven Sisters were the driving force behind the 69 takeover, but they put some of the men up front. I think later on, with the later groups, you didn't really have those gender divisions. Women were much more involved across the board in all the decision making. So it didn't come to the, I think if you look at 69, class of 69, that could be four. Yeah, I think there are gender divisions. I think starting with my class and then moving forward, I think the gender disputes just evaporated. Yeah, we had disputes, but it was not about gender. It was about politics, etc., and everybody had an equal voice.
Would you say that in the class of 69, there were disputes about gender? There were discussions, or was it just kind of the that the positions were divided based on gender?
I don't know. I just know how because again, I came in as a freshman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We got into the takeover. The whole fall semester was sort of the build up toward the takeover, the disputes, the takeover, and then recovery after the takeover. So I did not get a chance to really know some of the 69 people as well as I knew the other people. But it's interesting. One of the things you haven't mentioned is the book The Burglary, which is very interesting because unlike the 69 folks, we were there and actually our names got published in some of the files that were released to the FBI. And it was interesting talking about the anti-war things. You would read the FBI files and then you realize when you'd go to meetings, it was all of a sudden you would have these outsiders who would show up, knowing where they would come from, et cetera. And they were the ones who were always advocating violence, and you had to step back and control these people. And then when you read the FBI files, you read that most of those were FBI agents who were actually the ones who were advocating violence. So they would just show up, and they would try to get people to do crazy things, but be disruptive, and then we'd sort of pull back and say, no, we can't get involved with these guys. So that was another thing that we saw, you know, sort of post-69. That you did have much more infiltration from outside.
Did that FBI infiltration affect how you interacted with the nearby community, like with other black communities around the college?
It did, because you never knew. I mean, you go to the meetings, you had people saying crazy things. I'm not going to do that. And you know, looking back, you realize those are the FBI people who were trying to get you to commit violent acts. So yeah, it did have the effect of dampening our desire or ability to work with outside groups outside of SWAT.
Great. I think we have some more questions about what courses within the Black Studies department you took, or more specifically,
sure.
what professors you worked with as well.
You're going. It's going to be interesting. The ones I remember were Clem Cottingham.
Mm-hmm.
I remember doing. I think I took an urban studies type course from him, and I took several courses from Catherine Morgan and did a senior thesis on Black troops in World War II. There were a couple other professors, but at this point, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
What to do.
Okay.
How would you describe your relationships with these faculty members or Black staff members on campus?
Well, with the Black professors, they were good. They were good, solid relationships. Obviously, coaches with Catherine Morgan. My one regret is that Clem Cottingham wanted me to help him in some research and writing a book, and he was going to give me credit, and I was too busy. I didn't feel like it. Looking back, I feel stupid not having done that. He was a good guy, too. I went through some rough times with him, but you know, he's a good guy. I had good relations with the Black professional staff at Swarthmore because I lived in the preps. I guess they've been torn down now, but across the tracks in the prep, I did not have really any much of relationships with the non-professional staff that some of the other folks who lived up on campus had. So most of my relationships were with the teachers or the assistant deans, etc.
What about, I was also wondering what your relationship with faculty members outside the Black Studies department may have been, if you remember just the general maybe atmosphere in classrooms during the time, and in terms of how faculty kind of related.
Well, we had a lot of support from the faculty, and those who didn't support didn't, even if they didn't support, they didn't make an issue of it. But we had strong support from some of the, you know, it was a really radical white faculty, so we had strong support there. Again, particularly those who saw this in economic, the struggle in economic terms, and linked this struggle with the struggle against the war. The other professors, for instance, David Smith, Ray Hopkins, two of my political science professors, had great relationships with them. So what I did never, the politics, I pretty much left the politics outside of the classroom and inside the classroom, you know, we didn't really delve as much into the politics.
So do you think that these professors or other white professors taught Black students differently, or if there was just a sense that, you know, you were all Swarthmore students, and I don't know?
My sense is we were all Swarthmore students. I mean, I had been in predominantly white schools since seventh grade. So, you know, coming to Swarthmore was no big deal. It was just another situation where I was either one or two or the only one in the class. So, I mean, it didn't, by that point, after after maybe 6 years already, it was no big deal.
We've also, I think from other interviews, we've talked to some people who have said that, especially maybe around the time of the takeover, there was a lot of stress that some of the members of SAS felt, and Black students may have felt, and that it may have manifested itself in academics and kind of difficulty. And I was wondering if you wanted to or could speak to kind of just how people seem to be doing with classes during your time at the school and during the takeover?
Again, I didn't, to some extent, remember, I guess it was part of freshman year at that point was pass-fail, maybe all freshman year was pass-fail. So obviously, when you're getting a pass or a fail, it didn't affect me that much. During the other times, it really didn't, you know, it just didn't affect me. I mean, you had to buckle down, you had to study, you just kept going. Now, there were some classes where I got extensions. And yeah, it was, but actually the time I got the most extensions was when, not during the takeover, but the next year, the 70 takeover, the next year, with the Cambodian incursion. Mm. And we were also busy demonstrating that they let basically everybody get extensions. And I took extensions and I finally finished, got everything in August. It was the best year, the highest GPA I ever had at Swarthmore. So, but I guess, maybe it was me. I never let it get in the way. It was just, at some point I was a student and you just had to crank out the work. So no, I never felt pressured by the kind of takeovers. But recognize, I wasn't in the sciences.
Okay.
You know, the sciences were very tough anyway. And so if you were in biology, chemistry, maybe math, yeah, I don't know. But I was not in the sciences. So.
Thank you. I was wondering if I could actually ask another question as well about kind of your involvement, it sounds like, with the Vietnam protests. And kind of just in general about the interests of maybe like looking at the student body as a whole and then looking at the interests of SAS or the interests of white students. I noticed in 69, there seemed to be a little bit of a difference in terms of SAS advocating its goals and then like the radical caucus that was meeting at the time advocating student power, and that maybe those butted heads in terms of what different groups felt like were more important to achieve in a timely fashion. And I was just wondering in your experience, because it seems like you were involved in other radical action at the college, how well those interests went together or kind of maybe detracted from one another in different moments?
Well, I think you're, after that, we both went our own ways. I mean, we worked together on certain things, but bottom line is they did their thing, we did ours. And when we could do it together, fine. But it was, we didn't get in their way, they didn't get in our way. In fact, they with regard to the 70 takeover, we had very strong support. And we had white students sitting out in front of the president's office in support of us. So yeah, we, I think we all learned to coexist with each other.
Would you say that?
There wasn't any grand coordination. We didn't sit down and talk and we're gonna do this, you're gonna do that. It was sort of everybody kind of knew what folks were doing. It's a small campus, or you read the notices, et cetera, and everybody does their thing.
And was that also the case with the anti-war protests?
Yes, yes, yes.
So I think one other thing we wanted to talk about was your role in helping the college hire Black faculty members after the departure of Mr. Cottingham.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you wanted to speak to what you remember.
Well, I was involved in some of the interviews, not all the interviews. I was involved in some of the interviews. I remember distinctly one person we were interviewing. He was from a historically black college, and he came up and we started talking and said, well, one of the things we want you to do is teach black history. And he says, no, I don't teach black history, I teach European history. Well, I'm saying, no, we're looking for somebody in the black studies program who can teach black history. He says, no, I don't teach black history, I teach European history. So that was it. So, you know, back then, we went through an interesting process interviewing different people. But as I said, I was not involved very heavily in the interview process. I did a couple of interviews. That was the only one that stood out. I think I did talk to Catherine before she came, and obviously she's a wonder. She was a wonder, but again, I was not the person who was intimately involved in the interview.
So just a last, well, not the last question, but another question about, you mentioned earlier activism at other schools and how that may or may not have influenced SAS. And I was wondering if you could talk more about that, about how SAS or Black Swarthmore students saw themselves in relation to these other black schools or black students who were doing activism at other schools.
I can't speak to how the class of 69 was influenced. And recognize that a lot of the takeovers all occurred within a couple of weeks of each other. So obviously there was some influence and some coordination, but I was not involved in that. With regard to other campuses, mainly the Philadelphia campuses, such as Penn and Bryn Mawr and Haverford, we were all close. We knew each other. Doing, but we didn't act in a coordinated fashion. The nature of the isolation at Swarthmore. We'd get to Penn periodically, we'd have parties with them, we'd interact, but we didn't act together. With regard to Bryn Mawr and Haverford, we would take courses together, and even some black studies courses. I took some black studies courses over at Bryn Mawr, and they would take courses over at Swarthmore, but beyond that, we didn't coordinate.
You mentioned the isolation of Swarthmore, and I'm wondering, just because it seems like from addresses given by faculty members at the time or administrators at the time, there's this idea of Swarthmore being kind of like a place that's set apart, just in terms of like this liberal enclave, kind of almost utopian. And I was wondering just how that image maybe like matched up with your expectations coming in, and also kind of just your experience as a whole, and like how you saw that playing into just campus culture while you're at SWAT.
Well, I didn't really have an image of Swarthmore coming in. What
okay.
had happened was I was all set to go to University of Pennsylvania. And then I got invited up by SAS for a weekend. And I went to the recruitment weekend, and I really liked the people. And, you know, I think my interview, all my college interview basically consisted of 10 or 15 minutes with the Dean Hagedorn on a Saturday, early Saturday morning, that while I was up there, and we quickly scribbled together an application, and that was it. So, I'm not sure I had a real understanding or image of Swarthmore. I would not, when my kids, we went to through the college process with my kids, we obviously were much more deliberative than I was. So, yeah, I had an image of Swarthmore as a small school, small liberal school where everybody kind of got along and operated on consensus. But beyond that, I didn't have a deep sense of Swarthmore going in. Also, recognize Swarthmore were changing, because I think from talking to not necessarily folks at 69, but folks who had been there earlier, the pre-Swarthmore was the Swarthmore where, in quotes, giants walked the land. And it was a much more male-oriented, homophobic, probably, environment back then than by the time I came. By the time I came, really, the winds of change were sweeping Swarthmore. So all of a sudden, you know, the football players are looked down upon. And, you know, so like, you play football, what's wrong with you? That type of situation. So the whole image of Swarthmore was changing when I got there.
I was wondering, too, if you could speak more about that recruitment weekend that you went to, if you remember any particular members of SAS as standing out, or and also what they conveyed about the college, what they kind of talked about when they talked about Swarthmore.
I got to know, that's when I think I became really good friends with folks like Don Mizell and Noble Jones, and also the late James Batten. We became, JB and I were attended the weekend together. We talked a little bit about Swarthmore, but just as a place to get a good education, a very flexible, liberal place, where you could do your own thing, get a great education, and the whole emphasis then was the whole Swarthmore number one small college in the country, et cetera, and that type of thing. But it was a classic recruitment weekend where they spent more time just wining and dining you than selling you on the academic merits of the school.
Okay.
And just another question about that. How did they reach out to you? How did SAS reach out to you for that recruitment weekend? Did you know someone in SAS or something?
No, I think what happened was that they, by that point, they had the SAT scores.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know the drill. You get X amount on the SATs, and all of a sudden you get the letters from every college in the country. And so what they did was they did a cut on the SAT scores, so all of a sudden I'm off to Swarthmore for a weekend with three or four of my friends from other Baltimore schools that also got great SAT scores. So.
Great. I also had some. I'm interested in the media coverage as well of the college during the first year, but also during the second year. And we've talked a lot in class about the ways that the takeovers were portrayed, and especially like the use of words like militancy or.
Mm-hmm.
Or violence, and I was wondering if I don't know if you wanted to maybe speak to that, or just why you think that those because we.
It was the era.
Okay.
It was the era in the United States. You know, if you You were Fro, you were a black militant, regardless of whatever. And if you can't at that point separate Swarthmore from the rest of the country. The rest of the country was going through this, the throes, really, I call the death of the 50s. I mean, you had, and again, that's why 60, you keep seeing 68 in all the history books as a pivotal turning point, but it was a pivotal year. I think, you had the final death throes of the 50s, and Father Knows Best, and the Donna Reed Show, and all of a sudden, you moved from the Beverly Hillbillies to the Mod Squad. So you really need to see it in terms of the context of what was going on. And then you have the perception of Swarthmore. I know Spiro Agnew used to call Swarthmore the Kremlin on the Crum. you just got used to it. I mean, you really defined yourself as opposed to letting other people define you.
Did the way that the 1969 protest was cast, both like within the campus community and also like within maybe the national media, did that affect how you thought about the 1970 action? Like, was that maybe more something that you were conscious of, the narratives that kind of erupted around 1969, or not so much? It was an independent action for you.
It was an independent. I mean, maybe I should have, but at 18, 19, you don't necessarily think of everything you should think of. But no, I didn't. I felt we had to do what we had to do, and we were right. I just ignored that. Also recognized that, and for better or worse, I may have been lucky in that as a freshman, I really wasn't subject to the intense media focus that some of the seniors had been. And they weren't around. As I said, by that point, that really was that takeover was run by the juniors and sophomores. If for no other reason, there were only a few seniors, and they were focused on getting into med school and other things. So it was really the juniors and sophomores who win that.
You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that by the end of your time at Swarthmore, you were labeled a communist. So if you could talk a little bit more about those labels, like communist, militant, and how they were used to...
Well, it was, I was in the black community. I responded, well, you're a Jesus freak. So, I mean, because again, that was when you started having the tension between SAS and the gospel choir. You had some people in the gospel choir who thought that the folks in SAS are far too militant or radical for them, as I said, communist, and then some of us thought that they were, it was a term back then, Jesus freaks, that they were just too focused on God or too focused on religion, and they had to expand their options. So.
So is there anything that you think we missed, anything that you would like to share that we necessarily didn't think of?
No, I think we covered everything. It was pretty extensive.
Okay. I actually had one more quick question. Sorry about the...
Oh, yeah, no. I've cleared the afternoon.
Okay, thank you. About the BCC and the space, we read, I think, that you were using lodges 4 and 5 or 5 and 6 and at the time when you were asking for the Robinson House. And I was kind of wondering how you were using those spaces and kind of the need for the Robinson House over some of the other options that the college kind of offered. I think it was like a Wednesday tour that President Cross led you guys on, where you looked at a fraternity as well and really wanted the Robinson House.
Yeah, I think it was... We were using the lodges as meeting rooms / classrooms, but if you know the lodges, there was no security there. People wandering in and out, and there was just a concern about security and people wandering in and out, and people spying on us. With regard to the frat houses, I don't know if they're even still around. but they were pretty tacky by the late 60s, because quite frankly, the except maybe for the DUs, they were pretty much dying. You know, I had, early on in my freshman year, I had joined the Cappies, which was a fraternity, and it was a local fraternity because it had gotten kicked out of National for admitting black folks.
Mm-hmm.
And our frat house was really ratty, you know, and most of the others are pretty ratty too. So again, you know, the frat houses were pretty bad shape. The Robinson House, on the other hand, was in good shape. You could run a lot of programs there. You could have meetings, etc. So I think that's why we opted for the Robinson House.
Okay. How often was that space used once it was given as the BCC? Like how often did black students tend to meet there?
On a daily basis. Folks met there on a daily basis, not only in meetings, but just a place to hang out and gather. You had folks who were living there, and then you had people would just come over, gather. I didn't, but a lot of folks used to eat their meals over there. They would just do their own cooking over there. So one way or another, it got used on a daily basis.
Okay.
Do you have any other questions?
I guess I did have just maybe one.
Sure, hey, no, don't feel bad.
One or two more about Black Studies and about how you kind of articulated what you wanted that to look like at Swarthmore, if you were looking at other programs at other schools, or how you kind of built that idea for the program.
We were looking at programs at other schools, but as important, we were looking for someone who had a vision, who could make it happen. And again, that's why I think Catherine really became the person, because she came with the vision, recognized that, again, we're anywhere between 17 to 20, 21. We're not academic experts. We know we want a viable Black Studies program, but we weren't in a position to really get into the weeds or the nuts and bolts about what a program should or shouldn't look like. But what we were looking for was someone with the academic background who knew what a program should look like and could establish and implement. And that's what Catherine Morgan did.
Right. And then the makeup of those early classes, was it mainly black students or black students and white students a mix, or?
It was primarily black students, but it was a mix. Okay. It was a mix.
Okay. Do you remember how maybe some white students or white faculty kind of responded to the idea of black studies? Do you remember hearing anything?
Well, not really. I did have one idiot in freshman year who, when we were talking about black studies and black history program, well, his response was, well, maybe there's no such thing as black history, whereupon I promptly gave him three or four books to read, which he never read. The irony is, what really scary is, I think he's since gone on to be a history teacher. I don't worry about that. But yeah, I know. But aside from a comment or so like that, you know, I didn't interact with the people who would have negative comments. I really didn't. I think we had one episode where we had a debate with the student council over some of that, and they were opposing it. And I was told I was really brutal. I was just speaking my mind. And afterwards, somebody said, "How could you say stuff like that? What did I say?" I just told what I said what I thought. But anyway, for the most part, for better or worse, I didn't have a lot of dealings with the people who opposed us.
Okay, thank you.
I actually have another question. I know you said that you were closer to the professional black staff because you lived across the tracks. But I was wondering if you had any memories of black staff on campus, whether they were professional or non-professional, supporting the SAS actions and the SAS protests in 1969 and in 1970.
I don't have any memories of support. I had been told by some of the Seven Sisters and some of the other females that they got support. I never got anything. The only thing I remember was we're in the admissions office, and the black woman who always was on the door at Parrish in the evening tried to break in and tell us that we should go, we were wrong, we should leave, we were, you know, it was destroying ourselves and the school, etc. But no, I don't. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that story a little bit more?
Well, that's what happened. All of a sudden, she's banging on the door, telling us, "Get out, get out. We shouldn't be taken over. We don't know what's good for us, etc. We're wrong." You know. But I mean, that was about it. And you know, again, but that happened. And at the same time, during the same time, the administration found the one or two black folks who weren't involved in the takeover to speak out publicly against them, us, and to use administration use them as a spokesperson to show out we were just crazy Negroes. But you know, that was life.
Okay, yeah, that was another division I was kind of interested in. Is you said that in general you felt like you had kind of a supportive faculty, like a radical white faculty or a very mm-hmm. liberal white faculty. So in terms of this, like, a hesitancy to kind of make change at the college, do you think then that was definitely coming from, like, the dean's office, like, an administrative level? Like, where do you think...
No, it was from the faculty as well. I mean,
okay.
That was... It was clearly... obviously, they're very conservative faculty members as well. But the one thing the Swarthmore faculty was very good about was keeping the arguments inside the faculty. So the students really didn't, you would hear rumors, et cetera, or things would pop out, and then all of a sudden, wow. But you wouldn't really know what was going on in the faculty meetings. But clearly there was clearly conservative faculty members. And you know, I guess to some extent we had this black militant image, so the conservative faculty members, for the most part, wouldn't dream of going near me, so.
Okay. No, that's really interesting. One thing I also, looking back at the Phoenix supplement from that week, and I know this is probably a hard to remember kind of detail, but there were reports that seemed like someone was speaking pretty closely to the faculty. Like, it seemed like faculty meetings, the proceedings within faculty meetings were kind of being relayed to the community. And I know, like, the faculty themselves were kind of relaying minutes as well. But there was also a Liason group where it was... Steve Piker, Urban, Professor Urban,
mm-hmm.
and Professor Wood,
yep.
who were licensed to SAS. And I was just wondering if in any of your kind of interactions with those faculty or anyone else, you kind of got a sense of what was going on, or the faculty minutes were really pretty closed off despite...
I didn't have... Most of those folks are not in my department.
Okay.
So I didn't have any relationships with them. Now, again, some of the seniors probably did, but I didn't have it. Also... recognize that we weren't getting the Phoenix inside the admissions office.
Mm, okay.
So to some extent, we did not, we were closed off, so we didn't know what was going on.
Okay, thank you. And I get this is moving toward final questions, I promise. In terms of kind of, you came to Swarthmore and you helped with all these, changes at the college. It seems like some students graduated and kind of didn't look back. And I was wondering kind of what your relationship with the college and with just kind of keeping up with also just members of your class year, what that's been like for you personally, and if you've been back for any reunions or anything like that, or just what your relationship has been with to the school.
Well, I haven't looked back. I still keep in touch with some folks that I've in my class or in the class immediate or in the class of 73 that I've been close with, and 73 I still keep in contact. And periodically I'll come back to the school. Still have fond memories. Unlike a lot of folks, I never left Swarthmore embittered. I was fine. I mean, I figured I had a good experience. I learned a lot. I think the school was good for me. It was a pretty sheltered environment which allowed me. I went in, you know, 17. I thought I knew everything, but I really realized back that I didn't realize how young I really was going in. and it was a sheltered environment that allowed me to grow up and to learn and explore. Went on to Yale, and I found that that was a much larger school, much colder environment, and I thought, boy, these folks are full of themselves. I mean, they can't, for the most part, hold a candle to this world for people, but nobody could tell them that. So no, I had a positive view, and since I have been back to a few reunions, and one of the things I've noticed in some of my reunions is I've gotten to really reach out to some of my white classmates that I had gotten friendly with freshman year, or was very close, and then we had to take over. We all went our own ways. That they were really neat people, and I wish I'd gotten to know them better and to stay in touch with them a lot more than I have. But no, unlike a lot of, there were some folks, particularly some of the women who left Swarthmore and Bigger. I was not one. I mean, I had a good experience. I got decent grades, obviously. Was able to go on to law school with no problem. So it was all positive to me, and I think back fondly on the school.
Okay. Any final thoughts?
No, I think we've covered everything, unless you have one more question. Just kidding. But
thank you so much for speaking with us. It's just really great to hear from someone who's there at that time, who can share insight that we don't have as researchers or historians.
Yeah, and
it was my pleasure, and thank you for teaching me how to work Skype.
No problem. Yeah, thank you so much. It was so nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you. Take care now.
Thank you. Have a good day.